Hey, this is Dan Weldon, and you need more front wing.
Welcome to Forefront Wings Indianapolis Wrap-Up Podcast as we look back at last weekend's events at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the centennial running of the Indianapolis 500. This is site co-editor Paul Dalby, flying without my wingman Steph tonight as she is busy tending to some other obligations. But in her place, I'm pleased to be joined by ESPN.com motorsports writer John Orovitz. John, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure. Hello.
All right, John, let's, I don't even know quite where to start with the 500 wrap-up. So let's just start at the top of the pylon here, and let's talk about Brian Herta, Autosport, Dan Weldon. I'll be the first to admit, when we sat at the Mahaffey Theater at St. Pete, when they announced this deal back at the end of March, I was somewhere between amused and annoyed when I kept hearing them talk about, well, you know, we wouldn't do this if we didn't think we could win. I think we're going to be competitive. I think we're going to have a shot. And I'm just thinking, this is a team that has one IndyCar race under their belt that they barely made in by an unforeseen miracle last year. How can this team consider that they're going to go to Indianapolis and be competitive? And quite honestly, I thought if they qualify, I thought they were going to need a good effort to qualify. I guess I've got the egg on my face now. So...
I don't think anybody took them seriously when they stepped out in the Mahaffey Theater and said, well, we can go win this race. I mean, let's face it, Dan Weldon, he's got a little bit of hyperbole in him. He talks things up. He tends to exaggerate. So when Dan Weldon's saying, you know, well, we're going to win, you're like, all right, that's just Dan being Dan. But, you know, Brian Herta seemed quietly confident about it, too, and there's good people there. And this is a case where I guess the sum of the parts was greater than the whole on paper, because you'd think it would be impossible for not just a small team or a part-time team, but a one-off team. I mean, they had one race on their schedule this year. They went out there and they just did a quietly professional job. And the thing about it is when it came down to it, it wasn't that huge of a surprise, because Weldon, he ran all day in the top four, the top five, the top six. You got to say that the Ganassi team gave it away, but this is, you know, this is the fact that the IndyCar Series is in their 8th or 28th year or whatever it is with the Dallara Honda, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you know, it's bad to have a spec car that's around that long, but on the other hand, it's good, because eventually the small teams are going to figure out what Penske and Ganassi and formerly in the past Andretti Green were doing to make their cars so fast. There was a lot of parity at the Speedway this year. I thought it was amazing that four of the nine, the fast nine people were part-timers, and something like 10 of the first 24 were part-timers that got in. They just kind of threw the form book away at Indianapolis this year, and I think that's just one of several factors that made it the best Indianapolis 500 in at least 15 years.
Well, when IndyCar went to this spec formula back in 2006, this was one of the things that they had talked about. They said, you know, now everyone's going to be on even footing. Everyone's going to have the same access to the same equipment, and we're going to see parity. And of course, that hasn't necessarily happened, particularly on the ovals. But now here we are 5 years removed from that, and now we're starting to see, I think, Penske and Ganassi have finally hit the ceiling. There's just literally nothing more they can get from these cars. And now the rest of the field is starting to catch up. Don't you think that's probably where we are at this point?
That's probably a good way of putting it, Paul, that they've kind of hit the ceiling and they've just completely maxed out the development on these cars. And it's kind of beyond words when you think of some part-time team coming in and doing this at the Indianapolis 500 of all places. But And that's just it. I mean, you think ahead to next year, you think about 2012, and some people think that bringing out a new car is going to play right into Penske and Ganassi's hands, but I think as we saw in the Champ Car Series in 2007 when they brought out that DP01 car, you had Walker Racing win a couple races, you had HVM win a couple races. I mean, sure, Newman Haas won the majority of them, and Bourdais ended up as the champion, but at the same time, bringing out a new car shook things up, and it's bizarre that having an old car is kind of what shook things up at the Speedway this year. And one of the things going forward, you hear about teams not being able to afford new equipment or not being able to afford an aero package or whatever, you know, you quietly start to hear talk about equivalency formulas and a way to be able to keep some of these Dallars on the grid. And it just shows that when there's a good database of information out there and you've got good people applying it, you can run a competitive race team, and you don't have to have the budget of Penske or Ganassi. And this year, Ganassi in particular just seemed to be a little bit too clever for themselves. And if they were that desperate about shaving 10 or 20 pounds of fuel out of their car to the point where they ran them out and not only qualifying the race, both cars in both occasions. Those are just some pretty fundamental errors there. And of course, Penske was comparatively speaking, they were nowhere all month. Power was quick on a couple days, but they never, I mean, it's the first time since 1992 they didn't place a car in the top 10 in the race. So it's, you know, like I said, it's, they threw everything into a blender and mixed it up, and they came up with a pretty interesting result at the Speedway this year.
And like you said, you can look back all the way back to 95. And I mean, if you throw out 95, if you wipe that year out from your memory, I mean, you've got to go back quite a ways to think of a race before that where that was really so open and so, you know, literally until the last, 1,000 feet, we didn't know who was going to win this race. There were so many different scenarios playing out over the last 40 laps that everything was constantly in flux. And, you know, you can go back to, maybe 91 when Emerson and Rick and Michael, those three were battling it out. But, you know, we haven't seen a race with this many, maybe 90 or 2005 or 6, you could sort of make an argument. But you haven't seen a race where there are this many different people in contention that could legitimately win if one or two call or one or two scenarios change. If we have a yellow lap, if there's another accident, you know, if Hildebrand may or may not try to make that pass. I just don't recall for a long time seeing an event that was this wide open at Indianapolis.
No, and right up to the last corner, too.
Yeah.
You know, they talked about after qualifying that, you know, it's the deepest field in 500 history, and I thought that was, well, not really that much of a stretch. It was a slight stretch, maybe. I'd hesitate to compare it to some of the fields of the early to mid-90s. But at the same time, I've forgotten what I was saying. Get me back on topic here.
Well, I would say it may not be from a talent depth maybe as great as we saw in 94, 95 in that era. But I think if you look at it from the standpoint of who could possibly win this race, I think the competitive depth was every bit as deep as those fields. I mean, you could legitimately say, obviously, we saw there are people not only in your top five, but once you start getting down to, you know, Dan Weldon in a one-off, Bertrand Baguette was a couple laps from winning this race. Danica Patrick, who's, you know, we'll talk about Andretti later, but obviously they had a horrid month, and Danica was in a position where if a couple yellow flags come out, she could win this race. You legitimately had 13 to 15 guys that could have won this race. And, you know, when you look back at 94, 95, yeah, there's a great depth to that field with much talent there. But were all of those talented people in cars and in equipment that had an equal shot of winning?
Well, you brought up the 95 race, and that was the last real crazy, you know, obviously you didn't have any Penske cars in it, and that kind of changed the focus of the race from the start. But at the same time, if you look at that 95 race, look at who was in position to win the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Master, before he won the car championship, Scott Pruitt. Who led the most laps in 1995? That's a good trivia question. And not many people would guess Mauricio Gudelman, who, honestly, if you look at what he did in kart between 96 and 2000 or what have you, the dude was one of the best super speedway drivers of the era, of that decade at least. And Michael Andretti was in contention in that race. Scott Goodyear obviously was in contention in that race, and of course, Jack Villeneuve ended up being the winner. And I can't think of another just super crazy 500 like that. I mean, just think back beyond that through the 80s and 70s. Yeah. What can you come up with? I mean, it's and this year is a lot like 95, and people – sometimes I cringe when people talk about 95 as a classic race just because of the way it ended. with the Scott Goodyear pace car penalty, when Scott Goodyear passed the pace car. Yeah, he passed the pace car, but the pace car wasn't being driven correctly. So Scott Goodyear got, you know, cheated out of an Indy 500 victory that was rightfully his. And I think that, that always leaves a sour taste in some people's mouth about the '95 race. This year didn't have it. I mean, this year, it's, I think it's kind of important to point out that, did you look at the average speed? It was 176 miles an hour. It was the fastest Indy 500 of the IRL era. And in fact, it was the fastest Indy 500, I believe, since 1991. And that's, that says a lot for the quality of the people in the field, because if your average speed is high, it means you're not getting a lot of cautions, which probably means you're not getting a lot of crashes. The double file restarts, everybody thought they'd be mayhem, but they were spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were a couple of them where the racing was just wonderful. And some guys, Tony Kanaan, Graham Rahal, they really took advantage of them and made up a lot of places. So it was a classic year in the sense that there were a lot of these storylines, potential winners up to the end, Hildebrand, Danica. You know, either of the Target guys could legitimately claim that they could or should have won it. You had Weldon coming through at the end. He was never right up front, but he was always kind of lurking there in the top five. So all these stories kind of converged, but at the same time, it was a clean 500 with this totally memorable ending. And I don't want to say that J.R. Hildebrand crashing was a good memorable ending, but it wasn't a sour memorable ending like Scott Goodyear passing the pace car in 95. And, you know, people, God, I hope J.R. Hildebrand comes back and wins Texas or something just to get his mind right, because, by golly, that kid is going to be known forever as the kid that crashed on the last corner of the last lap of the Indy 500.
Yes, I'm afraid so. Before we get completely away from Weldon and BHA here, you have a great sense of history of the 500 like I do. Do you recall another win that was as unexpected as this? The first one that came to mind was Big Al in 87, you know, bringing the show.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
But when you think about it, Big Al, that's a four-time Indianapolis 500 winner driving for Roger Penske.
Right.
It's hard to necessarily call him an underdog in that situation. I mean, do you have to go all the way back to, what, Graham Hill in 66? I mean, or do you...
That's what Donald Davidson's pulling out, you know, in terms of the one-off guy going back and winning. And my memory's not long enough to know whether they contested any other races that year. I know they ran in the, they actually ran a USAC race at Fuji in Japan at the end of 1966 on the Fuji road course that later hosted the Formula One race in Japan. And Graham Hill was part of that, so that's an interesting footnote to Indianapolis car history.
Yeah, I can't
think of anybody.
I can't either.
No other one-offs that have done it, which again makes it all the more astounding, because you look at the modern era and you think now more than ever it can't happen. But, you know, and maybe we've underestimated Brian Herta as a team owner. You know, clearly he was part of what made Andretti Green Racing great during its great era. And I hesitate to say that that was from 2004 to 2007, because if you look at their 06, they didn't do a whole lot in 06. And Frank Edey and Kanaan came back in 07 and had really good years. But you look at that golden era of AGR when it was Herta and Dan Weldon and Frank Edey, Kanaan is the fourth. And people like to give, I'm one of them who likes to give Frank Edey a lot of credit for the team's success at that time, both in terms of setting up the cars and just keeping things cool. But Herta was a big part of that, too, and I think if you talk to Dario, Dario's got a lot of time for Brian Herta. There's no question that those guys are good friends, and Weldon was kind of a junior member of the group, and, you know, Weldon's Weldon. He's got kind of his own unique personality, and in some ways it's, how should we put this, it's less authentic or realistic than, you know, there's a bit of a facade about Dan sometimes, I think. But for whatever reason, you know, those three guys that he was there with at Andretti Green did a great job of grooming him to be the champion driver that he is. He's a two-time Indy 500 winner now. He's an IndyCar Series champion, and arguably he could have won the 06 title as well in his first year at Ganassi. Brian Herta, I think, maybe doesn't get the credit that he should have for his role at that time. I like to say now that Frank Edey is the guy that set up the car, and he was the glue that kept the personalities in that team together. Herta wasn't so much tasked with that later because, you know, they moved him aside for Danica, in fact. And in the latter part of that, in 07, when it was still Dario and Tony, but the other drivers were Danica and Marco. You know, if you look at what's transpired in the years since then, it's obvious that Dario was kind of holding it together in 06 and 07, because as soon as he left, they kind of all got at each other's throats, and it showed in the results as well. So Herta, he's an interesting story just in the overall timeline of IndyCar racing. He broke in the 93-94 driving for Foyt, and he had some pretty impressive runs, and then he had a horrible accident at Toronto. The last corner leading onto the pit straight there used to be really dangerous. I mean, it's still really dangerous. It's a big balls turn, but it used to be really bad, and Herta had a huge crash there, and he busted up his legs and his pelvis in the summer of 93, I believe. It might have been 94. And it was a setback for his career. He got his break then with Ganassi in 95, but it just didn't, the combination didn't work. And if you look at Brian and if you look at Chip, you can see why from a personality standpoint that maybe it didn't work. It's unfortunate that he didn't. And of course, you know, Brian will always be associated with being that famous pass by Alex Zanardi at the Corkscrew at Laguna Seca in 1996. And Brian came back and won a couple of kart races, and he won a couple of IRL races as well. And, of course, he's famous for possibly spinning out on purpose to help Marco Andretti win a race at Sonoma. But he's one of the good guys in the sport. I mean, he's a great guy. I like him because he's kind of a rock and roll music enthusiast. And if you've ever seen him get up there and mohawk his hair and do his Johnny Rotten or Sid Vicious impression up on stage, it's not what you'd expect out of Brian Herta. But at the same time, it shows that he's a pretty multidimensional guy.
All right, let's change gears for a while here. Let's get away from Weldon to Herta. Let's talk about what in the world is going on at Team Penske right now. Elio and Briscoe just had a terrible start to the season. Not necessarily their faults, but the results nonetheless have been disappointing. This was supposed to be where Penske was to turn around their season. Now they leave Indianapolis in shambles. Power is just clinging to his point lead now as we go to Texas in a couple weeks. What is going on at Penske, and are they starting to devolve somewhat with this current trio?
I think that's a fair assessment, and one of the crazy things you can say about this Indianapolis 500 is that Will Power qualified fifth and finished 14th and left with a bigger points lead than he started with. He actually increased his points lead by 2 points because they award points for qualifying, and he qualified fifth, and Frank Giddy was ninth, and Dario finished a couple of places ahead of him in the race, but it didn't make up for it. You know, the problems at Penske, it's either a good problem or a bad problem. Their problem is Will Power, because he went in there and he won a lot of races, and he was faster than the other guys, and he kind of demoralized the other guys, and they're just not right. I mean, Castro Neves, you can probably conclude that in the early part of the season, Power was winning pole position in every road race. Elio was pressing. He was just, you know, pushing and trying to make things happen. And that doesn't work. If you press and you push at the wrong places, it kind of backfires on you. And he's ended up being involved in a bunch of these silly accidents this year. And Briscoe, he's always been kind of hot and cold. The guy's extremely talented. He's extremely capable. He's mistake-prone. We've seen that over the years. I don't want to pin this thing that happened in the race with Townsend Bell on him. It doesn't look like he was at fault there. Excuse me. But at the same time, Briscoe, over the years, he's had a tendency to have trouble finishing races. And just when it looked like he was really getting it together in terms of a championship, he made that mistake in Japan a couple years ago when he spun out, accelerating out of the pits. I got a little bit too eager at the prospect of having a big lead, gaining a lap on the field, and spun on his pit exit. So what you've got there is, I think with Briscoe and Castro Neves, you've got a couple guys who are not very consistent performers. They're kind of volatile, maybe in their temperament, as well as their performance on the racetrack. And they're getting beat like a drum by their teammate. And that's got to be frustrating. It's got to be demoralizing. And you know, you can go into the truck with him every night and look at his traces and figure out where he's losing and gaining time, or I don't think he's losing much time to him. And that's just tough. Elio is 36 years old now, and I think you can go back, and I think the only exception to this rule, drivers they get to 37, 38 years old, and they just start to lose it, whether it's eye-hand coordination, or whether they're raising families and they're just a little bit keeping an eye on the mortality factor or what. But guys tend to lose it in their late 30s. The only exception to that rule was really Mario Andretti. Rick Mears is about the only guy that actually quit when he was still truly at his peak. And Castro Neves may be getting to that point in his career. He's in his late 30s now. He's been driving Indy cars. He started in the kart series in 98, I think it was. Been around for a long time. Might have even been 97. And he's got a new family. He may just be kind of winding down toward the end of the career. Guys like that often turned into Indianapolis specialists. You think of Hal Unser or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And you can see Ilya turning into an Indianapolis specialist. Shoot, we all thought Dan Weldon was an Indianapolis specialist, and maybe he is. Briscoe, I don't know. He's just, you know, he's really good on his good days. He's really bad on his bad days. And frankly, you've got to, of the Penske drivers, you've got to be most concerned for Briscoe's future. I mean, if they're going to get out of two cars next year, he's going to be the odd man out, because I can see Roger being loyal to Elio, but Elio's got to turn it around on the track too. He's just, this rough patch it's reached five or six races now, and he's, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if he can turn it around and become a threat to win again.
Well, I was going to ask you, how warm do you think Ryan Briscoe's seat is right now?
Well, that's a tough one to assess. I mean, last year when they were on the brink of going down to two cars, he was obviously going to be the man out. And he didn't really learn that he was in for this year until after last year ended. I would say it's somewhere between low and medium at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He's got two-thirds of a season to turn things around, but he's got to do it in such a way that they justify continuing to run three cars. As you can see, it's not like the glory days when they had Marlboro or Philip Morris, and they had all the money that they could spend. Penske Racing hasn't really had to sell sponsorship for many, many years. It's a tough climate for that. It's improving greatly, I have to say. But at the same time, you know, they've got AAA, and they've got Shell Pennzoil, and they've got GuidePoint. They've got a bunch of sponsors on Elio's car. They've got their rotating sponsors on Briscoe's car. It doesn't have Izod for every race. They're running Penske Truck Leasing and that kind of stuff on there. So they're still obviously not completely fully funded for a three-car effort. There's strong and stable support there from Verizon. And by the way, I think Will Power's Verizon commercial is hilarious. People would think Will Power's wouldn't, you know. No, I the first time I watched that, I'm like, you know, hey, the old Aussie nailed that one. But yeah, Briscoe, I think unless he puts a couple wins on the board here in the next six or eight races, his position's pretty tenuous. That's just an opinion, mind you.
Well, speaking of sponsorship and business issues at Penske, we saw at Indianapolis the logos of Hendrick Motorsports on the end plates of a couple of the Penske cars this weekend. Do you know anything about that? Do you know anything that might be in the works between those two teams?
Nothing. No. I saw that on the internet, and I'm like, well, that's interesting, and that's about as much as I thought about it. It just, you know, Roger Penske and Rick Hendrick, I'm sure they're good friends. They both sell a lot of cars. Maybe there is something to it. Who knows? But it's too early to tell. I certainly haven't tried connecting those dots yet.
Back on Will Power, Steph and I have had these discussions offline, and I think we kind of take a little bit different opinions to this. Can Will Power win the championship this year with his current pit crew? Or do things need to be shaken up there to start to avoid some of these gaffes that seem to keep popping up on the number 12 team? They had the loose wheel this week. They had the, you know, the issue at Chicago last year that ended up costing them a championship where they just didn't give them enough fuel to make it to the end of the race. We've seen a few other instances where the pit crew on Power's team has really cost him races and valuable points. Do they need a shake up on the 12 team?
Now you bring up an interesting point there, and if you think about it logically, and obviously Penske is a multifaceted organization, when they put Power's team together, it was from their old ALMS team, where they successfully ran some Porsche Spiders there in the P2 category of the ALMS for a couple of years. But if you've got a two-car team and you go to a three-car team, there's a good chance that you're going to kind of cherry-pick some people from each one and try to make the basis of the crew for the third team. And what you're saying is, yeah, maybe Penske needs to say, all right, if we're going to win a championship here, we need to maybe pool all our guys and give Power the A team and give Castro Neves the B team and give Briscoe the C team. You look at the 500 there, it seems to me Castro Neves' car, he had a tire problem at one point, but it seemed to me on another occasion he had a lost wheel as well, or am I mixing them up?
I don't recall Elio having losing a wheel.
Okay, well, that may have been where he had a tire come apart because of running over some debris there. I may just be getting things mixed up. It might be time for that. One of the rumors I heard recently is that you've probably heard that the Motegi Oval has had some damage to the surface, some rippling to the surface. I was told this week that IndyCar has concluded a deal to actually race on the Motegi road course to honor the date for Twin Ring Motegi, but the race will actually be staged on the road course. I think that's a win-win situation. From an IndyCar perspective, they get something like triple the sanction fee from Motegi that they do for their domestic races, so it's important for their bottom line to honor that contract and make every effort to do so. But getting it back to our topic of willpower, if that's the case, it plays into his hands because, I mean, look at the guy's record on these road and street courses for the last couple of years. He's pretty unbeatable. I mean, he's been on pole position 80 or 90% of the time. He hasn't converted them all into wins, but I think that's not so much down to him as it is to the unpredictable nature of IndyCar racing itself with lots of yellow flags and full course cautions, less pure racing than Formula One. If you take into account the fact that he's going to get an additional road race on the schedule and you think to yourselves, do we really want the championship that bad? Maybe we should stack his pit crew. I think they've got to make that decision probably here in the next two or three races if they're going to do it. It'll be interesting to see if something like that happens.
Yeah, we just don't see these pit problems on the three car and to a lesser extent. I don't recall seeing pit problems really on Briscoe's car either. It just seems that the microscope just seems to be falling all the time on Power's car, and you know, whenever they need to perform, it seems like maybe that's the weak link there, and they're costing him valuable points. But
well, and the pit stops they're so critical these days.
Oh, especially yeah.
A lot of the road courses, you go to Mid-Ohio, you go to Sonoma, and you don't really have a realistic chance of passing somebody on the track. So the pit stops are hugely important there, and it's you got to be on your game, and you got to be on your game for all 17 races.
Right. New topic here again. Let's talk about KV. Once again, they put two cars in the wall early on in this race. You know, the Viso accident, maybe you could say that had something to do with, you know, with the trying to go past Hinch, and I think it was Mira on the bottom of, but they're going three wide on a restart. Just not a real bright idea. Sato is into the wall as well, and lo and behold, Tony Kanaan once again proves that he can win this race in any car from any starting position. How long can KV continue to fund this disaster?
KV's not funding it. The Venezuelan government is funding it, and Panasonic is funding it. And you know, the one thing you can say about Sato and Viso and all the crashes that they had last year, whether it was the insurance deductible or what have you, I heard that KV came out ahead. Which is pretty surprising if you've ever watched that YouTube collage of 40 crashes or whatever it was.
I think the final number I tallied up on the year, looking back through all the daily trackside report, I think it was 42 incidents last year in, 17 races?
I don't know what that works out to, but it's something like 2.2, you know, incidents per race, and that's that's crazy. That's almost one per driver per race.
And I think they're averaging two this year still. So, you know, it's
Yeah, and I don't know where Tony is in the points now. He's got to be in the top three or four in the points after finishing fourth at Indianapolis. I think that Tony moving to KV, it's got to be great for him mentally. I mean, let's face it, Andretti Autosport, that place is just, and it comes from Michael Andretti himself. It's a dysfunctional organization. And, you know, you can say what you will about Jimmy Vassar or Kevin Kalkoven. It's got to be a real breath of fresh air for Tony Kanaan to be just out of the culture, shall we put it, of Andretti Autosport. Tony's still got some mileage left. He's like Elio. He's getting into his late 30s now. He's 36. I know that because he's exactly 10 years younger than me to the day. And, you know, Tony, it was easy to see why he was getting demotivated in that atmosphere at Andretti Autosport, where so much attention is placed on Danica Patrick because she's Danica Patrick, and on Marco Andretti because he's Michael Andretti's son, and even on Hideki Muto because he was bringing the budget. I think it was a good break for Tony. He's had some good runs already this year. He's running consistently. He's not showing a ton of speed in qualifying, but you kind of expect that for guys in the later stages of their career. His racecraft is still there, which is obvious by any, you know, you can name just about any race this year, whether it was Barber or St. Pete or Indianapolis. And he's been very good for that team. That team desperately needed a proven veteran, somebody who's steady, somebody who can give them a direction in terms of their car development and just be kind of a stabilizing influence there. You've got Sato, he's not a young guy. I mean, he's in his 30s. He did Formula One for a long time. Vizo's a young guy. He's probably 24 or 25 now. But they're just wild. They crash a lot. They go fast on occasion. You hear the old axiom of it's easier to slow a fast driver down than it is to speed a slow driver up. But at the same time, there's got to be a happy medium where you show some speed and you're able to keep it between the walls for 200 laps. And I think people were hoping that Sato, he had a decent run. I forget whether it was at St. Pete or led some laps at Brazil down there, and they had kind of a baffling pit strategy that took him out of contention for the win. But I think people were kind of hoping that he'd turn the page a little bit and finish some more races this year, and he has a couple times. He's looked good on a couple of occasions, but on a couple of occasions it's the old put it in the wall Taku. And Indianapolis, I'm afraid, was one of those. And Vizo, I mean, I'm not sure what to say about Vizo. He's a decent enough race car driver, but if you go back to his time in Formula 3000 or GP2 or whatever it was called when he was there, I mean, the guy crashes. He crashes a lot. He crashes early. He crashes often, and that pattern's not going to change. And he might bring you a top five occasionally, but I hope the checks are big enough to justify the amount of damage he causes to the equipment.
The thing that I don't understand, it's just, the frustrating thing, I guess, is that, you know, the iterations of KV, whether you look at, you know, the PKV or whatever they were, you know, in their later...
The Craig Pollock sighting lately? Remember
yeah.
It was Pollock and Kalkoven?
Exactly.
I went to that initial press conference back there in 2003 or 2004.
Well, when you look at those iterations, this team proves that it has what it takes to win. They you know, even when the first year of the merge in 2008, they were the top Champ Car team that came over, you know, they ran the best of those teams. I think this team.
Yeah,
really,
who were their? I don't want to interrupt you, but who were their drivers?
Right.
With
yeah.
Will Power and Oriol Servia. I mean, they had two very, very, very good drivers, and Servia is an underrated guy who I've got a lot of time for.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I still think this team can win. But I don't know that they can win when they continue to be rebuilding cars week after week after week. You know, I understand that Lotus maybe is funding some of this, and obviously Venezuela and Panasonic are kicking in the money. But there's a difference between just surviving financially and being able to develop your cars. You don't get to develop your cars and your team when you're spending every week rebuilding what you had to crash the week before. And that's where I think this team is continuously behind the eight ball. And whether they have Tony Kanaan or Will Power behind that wheel, or Dario Franchitti, or if Rick Mears in his prime got behind that wheel, they can't make this team win when they're constantly trying to play catch-up from crashes all the time.
And they have to ask themselves a fundamental question. Are we going to hire drivers and try to win races and therefore bring in sponsorship because of our track record of success, or are we just going to bring in pay drivers like E.J. Vizo,
right,
like Takuma Sato, like Mario Moraes? So I think it's a step in the direction for them, the fact that they've actually hired a proven professional race car driver, Tony Kanaan. And because of that, they were able to kind of step on Paul Tracy's toes a little bit and get Geico to commit for a whole season. But, yeah, they just, you know, what are they? Are you a rent-a-driver team, or are you actually going to try to challenge Penske and Ganassi? Well, if you're going to try to challenge Penske and Ganassi, you have to play the game the same way they do, and that is you hire the best people. And that means paying the best people. And if it means paying them out of your pockets, that's one thing. If it means actually having the sponsor to do it, that's another thing. But the bottom line is that you hire the best drivers available. And with all due respect to Mr. Sato and Mr. Vizo, they're not the very best drivers available to them. It was a kind of a lucky stroke of fate that Kanaan fell under their hands after his deal with DeFerrin Racing or Dragon Racing or whatever you want to call it blew up. Yeah, that's a tough one, and I think that's one of the things that you know, Paul, that frustrates some fans about IndyCar racing. They see these rent-a-riders, and of course we saw a classic example of that at the 500 this year when A.J. Foyt sold out a qualified car to Michael Andretti so that Ryan Hunter-Reay and his sponsors could be in the 500. What are you going to do? Are you out here trying to win races, or are you just, you know, there aren't too many people that are actually out there in the business of fielding cars to try to win races. And, you know, it's Roger Penske, it's Chip Ganassi, and gosh, dare I say it, it's Dale Coyne. He's hired Justin Wilson. He's hired Sebastian Bourdais. He's actually paying him to drive his race car and pretty much out of his own pocket, too. And you got to hand it to Dale Coyne for having that kind of commitment to win, and you wonder about Vasser and Cal Coven. And the other thing, if you want to talk about KV, the other weird thing is okay, they've got Lotus, and they've got this Lotus support. Well, then why is Lotus hiring John Judd to build their engine instead of Kevin Kalkoven, who owns Cosworth? Why is the Cosworth engine not the Lotus engine? We wondered when they made the Lotus announcement at the LA Auto Show last year why there were no KV Racing people there with the KV Racing car. I sincerely hope, it's because Cosworth is holding out to have Ford as a partner for their engine. Keep your fingers crossed, because if we had Ford Cosworth going up against Ilmor Chevrolet, it would be a fantastic thing, both on the track in terms of competition and in terms of the support it would give to the series and the signal that it would send out about IndyCar racing really being back.
It would be 1992 and 3 all over again from that standpoint.
Now, yeah, about that pesky Tony George and the way to mess things up.
We'll avoid that issue for the time being. Although there were,
hey, by the way, I should direct your listeners to this. On 1070 The Fan in Indianapolis yesterday afternoon,
yes,
Robin
just
Miller
going
and Tony
to say
George
that.
Were in studio for 2 full hours, and there should be a podcast available.
It started out
pretty tame, but by the second hour, it got pretty interesting.
It was a sensational 2-hour interview, and certainly well worth anyone going to listen to that. It was on the ride with JMV, and they maintained their civility. But I think there were some pointed barbs in the, like you said, the second hour for sure. It got a little tense.
It was great. Those guys had never been in a studio together. You know, they were, when Robin was at Channel 8 in 1989 or something like that, maybe they were. But it was kind of an unprecedented event. I can't believe the JMV got them on there for 2 hours. I was driving over to Columbus, Ohio. I'm like, this is great. Perfect entertainment for the ride.
And I thought Tony George handled himself very well. I think I know there was a lot that happened that hasn't been put out publicly. I'm sure both good and bad. I thought Tony was very forthcoming and admitting that he listened to people that he shouldn't have. He admitted that he was very young at the time. But I believe he was I think he was 30 when he took over the Speedway in 90, so I guess he would have been about 33, 34, 35 when the genesis of the IRL came. And he admitted that he was young and he got advice from people that may not have had, certainly didn't have his interest at heart.
Well, you mean the fact he had Bill France in one ear and Bernie Ecclestone in the other?
Among those, others. And
those guys had the interest of IndyCar racing as a whole.
Right, right. But yeah, it was a fantastic interview, and I thought they both composed. It was very much typically what you would expect out of both of them. Robin, you know, shot from the hip and you know, kind of just let things fly. And Tony was very reserved and chose his words extremely carefully. And I think there was a lot of good information out of there. I don't think it necessarily healed any old wounds, but I think it got some of the thoughts out into public, and I would certainly recommend listening to that, as you were saying.
Anything we can do at this point to get the old fans back on board, it's like, okay, you want to call it the Dallara Honda, you want to call it Formula Crap Wagon, that's fine. But at the same time, the split's been over for 3 years. Tony George will tell you that it started in 1978 instead of 1996, and there's some truth to that. At the same time, we've been bickering about this for a long time. You know, yeah, you might not like the current cars, but there's a lot of compelling stories in IndyCar racing right now. If you can look past the fact that the cars are loud and ugly, there's some pretty good racing going on if you can just try to be open-minded and objective about it. And there's new cars, there's new engines coming next year, there's new bodywork potentially coming next year. You know, there's a lot to be thankful for. It's time to just quit bitching about it as much as you know, and I had to revisit this recently in this 10-part history series I wrote for ESPN.com. The facts are out there. The bottom line is that IndyCar racing, it's where it's at right now, and you can get on board or you can choose to continue bitching about it. And I wish more of these people would just get on board and say this is a better alternative to NASCAR. It's a different alternative. I won't say better than Formula One, because Formula One show is pretty good this year. But it's, you know, it's a lot better than the other alternatives out there. I don't understand why people want to continue harboring this grudge. And the time is now. IndyCar racing is going to make a comeback. Get on board now.
I would certainly absolutely agree with everything you said. I know you and I have had some disagreements previously about, you know, what the current formula is. And the fact is that IndyCar didn't ask to be a specs formula. I mean, they didn't set out in 2003 when this Dallara came out. They didn't ask to be a one chassis and a one engine series. They certainly didn't expect for that chassis to be around 9 years later. But yes, it is what we have now. It is the state where we are. They are going to turn a page next year. There will be new engines. Hopefully there will be new aero kits. I think you're going to see a lot of new blood from both the manufacturers and hopefully from some new teams and some new participants coming on board, whether you bring existing teams like a Highcroft Racing into the series, or you grow organically and internally from somebody like a Brian Herta Autosport, or maybe like a Sam Schmidt continues to grow, or some of these other Indy Lights teams can step up and make that investment on an even playing field now. So I think from that standpoint, I think 2012, and like you say, the whole momentum is building. And at this point, anybody who wants to harbor those ill feelings and continue to dredge up the politics of the past, just get out of the way. And you either join us or get out of the way.
Keep it to yourself and, you know, keep it to yourself and don't kill our buzz.
Right. Yeah. Because the IndyCar from today is a lot better than the IndyCar from 2007 and before that. So,
or 2004, or definitely from 2001.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, you look at the early part of the century and you look at where the IRL was in 1999, 2000, and Penske came back in 02. Ganassi started doing it in 01. And I hate to harp on the fact that it was the professional teams that came in, but the top acknowledged teams of IndyCar racing before the split chose to be loyal to the IRL at that point, and it showed the quality of the competition. I mean, yeah, it's if you were an AJ Foyt fan or if you were a Panther Racing fan, it's probably not the greatest thing, but at the same time, you know, it's their responsibility to step up and compete.
I think Panther Racing would acknowledge it or feel much better about a win today than a win in, you know, 2000 against, you know, pick your team, Team Pelfrey, or, you know, any of these other teams that were on the budget.
PDM Racing. Bronco Brad Murphy and Dr. Jack Miller and those wonderful punchline names from the past.
There you go. You know, something else I found extremely interesting out of the Tony George and Robin Miller interview, and did you get the idea that Tony George, how do I say that? He came off
that Randy Bernard hasn't called him.
Yes, exactly. Did he seem bitter to you? Did
yes.
he seem disappointed?
Yes, both of the above.
Uh-huh.
Mad, bitter, disappointed. Surprised. I thought he spent the last half hour basically saying, lobbying for some unknown position, you know, saying that you'd think that Randy would have called a guy with my experience. Well, I don't know what to say about that. Yes, Tony does have experience in running a racing series and running a racing team, and many of the things he did were good, and some of the things he did were horribly bad, and I sometimes question his judgment in that regard. Yeah, Randy should have called him. Randy needs to extend an olive branch to Tony George. You know, those guys, I think they need to have a civil relationship. When Tony got reinstated to the Holman board, there were a lot of people that jumped to conclusions. They said, well, Tony and three of his buddies have been appointed to the board now, and look, it's the three sisters and Jack Snyder against Tony and the three buddies, and, you know, mom's the deciding vote, and what happens if mom has health problems or what have you. And it's funny, one of the things that came out is that Tony and Jack Snyder obviously aren't on the same page, and this is something that came out of the JMV interview. At one point, whether it was, I forget what it was that Tony blamed Jack Snyder for sending him to Houston in 91 to the CART meeting and trying to take it over, or that Jack Snyder told him to do the 25-8 rule.
I got the sense you said that Jack Snyder was the one that said he should resign from the CART board, is kind of what I got. Yeah, he kind of threw Jack Snyder's name out there.
Thing was, but it was kind of a snide, spiteful remark about Jack Snyder.
And, yeah.
And the whole reinstatement of Tony to the board, as you know, a couple months ago, was pretty controversial. It sent some waves to the IndyCar community. It actually shook a lot of people up. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people think that, you know, Tony created problems he shouldn't have caused. I thought it was interesting that he came out with that tone about Jack Snyder and it's, you've got to wonder with the way he was kind of lobbying, saying, I have the experience. I mean, what does Tony want to do? They offered him the opportunity to continue to lead the Indy Racing League, and he turned it down. What is this guy's motive? He doesn't communicate it, so we all just kind of have to guess at what he's up to.
He was very defensive as well about people having – or questioning Brian Barnhart and Tony or Terry Angstad. I mean, he was,
those are his boys. I mean, that was his management team.
Right. And he,
as you know, I mean, if Brian Barnhart's a controversial figure, anybody that reads Robin Miller's stuff, good gravy. They think that Brian Barnhart needs to be put out with yesterday's trash.
That is certainly Robin's opinion. I question how universal that opinion is throughout the paddock. I'm sure he has his detractors, but I often wonder if his detractors are quite as uniform in their.
Well, he's kept his job for a long time.
He's got
some kind of support.
He has support, but which side is he supportive? Is he supportive from the teams, or is he supportive from the administration? Or, unlike Robin says, does he have fairly universal support across both spectrums?
Mm-hmm. I think it's selective and influential.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where it's coming from, but I do think it is selective and influential.
So do you think there is a place for Tony George in the current IndyCar administration?
I think that if you bring Tony George back right now, it doesn't send the right message. Because if you look at the perception of the entire big picture, Tony's the guy that, whether it's right or wrong, he's viewed as the guy that broke it in half in 1996. He is credited as the guy that brought it back together in 2008, but by then it was too late, and IndyCar racing was a shell of what it was when he broke it apart. It's then, you know, if you look at the reaction of people, people panicked. IndyCar fans, people within the paddock, they panicked when the news broke that he was reinstated at the Holman board. It did not send a positive message. And we were in a period where there was all this good news and all this positive momentum for IndyCar, and then all of a sudden the news comes out, Tony George is back on the Holman board. And people freaked out, and not in a positive way. And I think that in itself, I hope that sent a message to the Holman board, the rest of the family. Tony George, I mean, he definitely has his fans and he definitely has his followers, but it just strikes me from my observation that the vast majority of people think that his actions have been highly detrimental to the sport of IndyCar racing as a whole. And bringing him back in the fold sent a message that was not reassuring to all the people who looked at who view Randy Bernard as a guy that's actually done good things and made things happen. Basically, if you're on board with the fact that IndyCar racing is growing again, a lot of it is because it actually has now a dynamic leader who is aggressive and hungry and who's out there selling the series and being a good front man, the notion of Tony George being involved with that, it frightens them. And, you know, some people think, all right, Tony coming back on the Holman board, it's just the first step to putting him back in charge of it all. Other people say Tony George is flying coach from St. Petersburg to Indianapolis, and Tony George is driving a Volkswagen Jetta. And these are both things that I have personally witnessed. And they think to themselves, you know, maybe his family just has a little bit of compassion and he's got some cash flow problems right now, and you put him back on the board and you can justify throwing him a couple $100,000 a year to take care of his expenses. The truth is somewhere in between. He's either coming back to take it over or he's just been thrown a bone because he's a bit destitute right now. The Holman George family and Tony in particular play things pretty close to the vest. But when you see Tony George, whether he's flying down to St. Pete on AirTran Airways and paying $30 to check his bags, whether he's doing that for show or for whatever reason, and when you see the guy driving a Volkswagen Jetta instead of a Mercedes S-Class, it does send some messages that maybe money's an issue for the man right now. I don't know, if They're on a pretty slippery slope if they allow him back into the fold, because there's a lot of negative sentiment toward him.
I think I would pretty much agree with that. I certainly don't want to rehash why the split happened and what was good about it and what was bad. Obviously, there is more bad than good. I think overall, the times I've met Tony George, I've liked him. I think he had some good ideas.
He's a nice man. He's a gracious man. And,
very.
And I think that
very.
He truly believed that what he was doing was right.
And I think some of the...
There's a lot of proof to say that a lot of it wasn't. And,
right,
and a lot of it has been great for the Speedway. The Brickyard 400, great for the Speedway. And a lot of these things, and this is the way I've come to sum it up, Tony George was very good for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He wasn't very good for the sport of IndyCar racing.
Yeah, I think, like you said, he certainly had the interest of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500 at heart. You know, some could even make the argument recently with the shenanigans that Mike Landretti and A.J. Foyt did as the owners. One of his one of his founding principles was to protect the integrity of the Indianapolis 500 against the owners, though he was specifically meaning CART. Unfortunately, as you said, he is such a divisive figure in the sport of auto racing. And I keep going back to something that I think it was, I don't know his name. It was, I believe he's the head of Mazda Motorsports. And I don't mean to quote him here, but I'll paraphrase him. When they recently announced the title sponsorship to the Mazda Road to Indy, he basically said the only reason this was going to happen is because Randy Bernard was in place now, and that Randy was finally willing to work with Mazda instead of taking this hard-line, hard-nosed approach. And though he didn't mention Tony George by name, he certainly inferred the tense relationship, I guess, that they had, that Mazda had with IndyCar under the Tony George administration. So if you bring that figure back into the fold, I'm with you. I think it sets us back, and it's, you know, I think he has good ideas sometimes, and certainly has good ideas toward the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but for growing the sport of IndyCar, I don't see how he fits into an administrative role at this point.
No, and I think there's an attitude out there that the Speedway and the Indy Racing League they had a bit of an arrogant attitude. And one of the big changes I've noted since Randy's been in charge of the series, they have, and this is from an Aero Media perspective, they've been a lot better about reaching out, and their accessibility is a lot greater. Anybody with a cell phone probably has Randy Bernard's number, and he takes the call. And mm-hmm. if he doesn't take the call, he calls you back.
Yes.
And when you can go directly to the CEO and get a call back, that's an amazing thing. I don't want to say that Tony was responsible for that culture of arrogance within IMS and the IRL, but I can tell you that it's changed since Randy's been on board. Some of it, I think, just comes from a fear factor. When it's a family-run business and it's a family member that's running it, they carry a lot of clout, and there tends to be a huge intimidation factor. And the fact that Tony, he's not a hugely outgoing guy, and it's interesting, you talk to people that know him well, people that worked at Vision Racing, and, you know, out in your blog community, there's a guy called Charles West,
mm-hmm.
who, he's worked for Vision Racing, and he's kind of parlayed it into a, you know, kind of a position in the blogging community. I mean, the guy defends Tony George to the hilt and thinks he's the greatest guy in the world. Tony is apparently a different guy if you do get close to him, but there's not many people he lets get close to him. My own relationship with him is distant at best, and then some of it's my fault. I'm not especially aggressive. I don't call up and bother people unless I've got something to bother them about. But he lets me know. He lets me know if I've written something that's to his dissatisfaction. And there's, you know, when there needs to be open dialogue, there's open dialogue. And in terms of professionalism and courtesy and just kindness to me and my family, I've got nothing bad to say about the man. And I do truly believe that many of the changes that he made and decisions he made, he really thought were in the best interest of the Indianapolis 500 and to a lesser extent IndyCar racing. But I don't think you can argue that the decisions he made were not best for IndyCar racing. And if you think about, and during the JMV Robin interview, he kind of poked fun at the numbers that were put out there about the amount of money of the Holman family trust that he spent. And it's basically estimated most people say between $500 and $700 million of the family money to start and sustain the IRL and build the Speedway road course and bring Formula One and just, you know, all the money spent during the Tony era. And he thought those numbers were exaggerated. But at the same time, I mean, the dude did spend a lot of their money. And, he's a polarizing figure, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how we quite got on that conversation, but it's a very interesting one. And again, I would point our listeners over to the 1070fan.com website and check out that
interview. It's must hear radio, or must here podcast or whatever the phrase is.
Absolutely. There is certainly a well-known tension, I think, between Robin and Tony. I think it comes through a little bit. Maybe not quite as much as between Robin and Brian, but certainly. So go check this out. let's see. Do we have anything else from the 500 to touch upon? The other things I had here were the disappointing end of the day for Alex Tagliani. It was a shame.
Well, there's a couple things. Okay, Tagliani, yeah, he ran good. You know, pole position, great story. He was competitive in the race. They kind of lost the handle on the car. We should talk about Servia and Newman Haas Racing.
Yes.
Because Servia, I mean, he's a great guy. He's got one win. He won a race for Newman Haas in the Kart Series. And he reminds me so much of my good friend Mauricio Gugelman, who's just a great human being. A superb race car driver, but for whatever reason, he just didn't have that 99th percentile or 100th percentile to make him a regular winner. Servia is a great guy, finished fifth or sixth, depending on who you believe in the 500. They moved him back to sixth because of the yellow light that eventually went on for Hildebrand at the end there. The other stories from the 500 I should bring up is that the crowd was better than it's been for 15 years. The atmosphere was better than it's been for 15 years. I mean, it truly felt like an Indy 500 there on race day, and all the stuff they had on race day morning with the vintage cars, both the group from 1911 and then the later cars, which went from, you know, 1912 to 1990 or 2000, actually, because the Montoya winner was out there. Great stuff. People loved it. And all the people that appreciated the history of the sport, you know, and the whole grandeur of the speedway and everything. People love that stuff. And, you know, this was the 100th anniversary, and they've got, you know, 5 years from now or whatever it is, they've got the 100th running. They shouldn't let off the gas on this. People love this history. They love to see these cars out there. They love to see the championship drivers coming back. So that was a big thing. Good atmosphere. And, you know, personally, I've just moved to Speedway, Indiana, about three blocks from the track, and I loved being a part of the whole atmosphere of the Indianapolis 500 and Indy Racing Cup making a comeback. I did this 10-part history, you know, decade by decade of the Speedway and the 500 for ESPN.com, and when I wrote the final installment, I realized that if you looked at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway 10 years ago in 2000 or 2001, the Indy 500 was the number three race on the totem pole. The Brickyard 400 had greater attendance. It was selling out every year. They were putting a lot of attention and promotional effort into the Formula One race, and even if it didn't have the numbers, it was still getting a lot of effort from IMS. The 500 had kind of slipped to number three on the totem pole. It was kind of coasting along on its own laurels. But if you look at take a snapshot at 2011, the Indy 500 is by far, it is the number one race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. That's the way it ought to be. I hope their attendance rebounds for the Brickyard 400 this year. It's not a great car race, but it is a good event. Anytime you can go to a race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, it's a great thing. I hope the MotoGP, I hope they're able to keep that for the future. Actually, my ideal plan would be to have an IndyCar race on the road course at the Speedway, but we won't go down that path. You know, I hope MotoGP continues to be successful and they can negotiate a contract extension because Jeff Belsis wants to keep it. But the great thing is just it's seeing the Indy 500 being back. It's just as somebody who's been going out there for 35 of his 46 years, it's just wonderful to see it come back again. And with Chevy coming in and the additional marketing power and everything, we've got to get the fans back on board. IndyCar racing is going to make a comeback, and you should be part of it.
Yeah, I cannot agree with you any more than you said. The historical stuff was just sensational to see.
Outstanding.
That was to see the Marmon Wasp being driven out there by Parnelli Jones was something that, you know, I guess it hasn't been done, I don't think, on the Speedway since 1961. So, you know,
that's correct.
To see how historic that was, to see, for me, to see the Lotus out there. I know you're a big Lotus fan. To see Al Sr. wedged in the Lotus. I mean, literally wedged in the Lotus. What was?
Oh, man, to see the 1990 car. You know, I was out there at the 9500 as a fan, and that was the fastest 500 in history with 185-mile-an-hour average.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a beautiful car out there.
Yeah, so to see those, I hope they, like you said, I hope they do more of this grandeur every year instead of just rolling out during the centennial era or, you know, when we had the 100th running coming up here in a handful of years as well.
Randy may not know much about the history of IndyCar racing, but when he learns about it, he respects it, and he realizes that it's an unbelievable selling point for the sport. This is, you know, you can talk about NASCAR. They've been around for 50 and 60 years. This has been around for 100 years.
Yeah.
Even more than that in Milwaukee, where we're going to be in a couple weeks. And, you know, there's been some bad times for IndyCar racing. It's gone through some changes in the last 20 or 30 years. But ultimately, they have the opportunity again to make it what it should be at this point, which I think it combines the best of traditional American racing on ovals with Formula One racing, the world standard for open-wheel racing. You've got these high-tech open-wheel cars that can race on road courses or ovals. It's the best of both worlds, and there's not any reason to let the politics get in the way anymore.
I absolutely agree. Well, John, I think we've covered pretty much all there is to cover here. I know it's getting late, and we've kept you for quite a while, so I greatly appreciate you spending some time with us tonight and going kind of rehashing these great stories from this weekend. And I know we got a little bit off topic with the Tony interview, but I certainly enjoyed that conversation as well. So thanks so much for joining us this week.
Well, let's do it again sometime soon.
Absolutely. We'll look forward to that. That's John Orovitz, motorsports writer for ESPN.com, who covers the IZOD IndyCar Series on a weekly basis. Be sure to join us next week as we preview the IndyCar Series event at Texas Motor Speedway coming up in a couple weeks, the Firestone Twin 275 Twin Bill, actually the doubleheader race weekend down there. Let me just take a moment on behalf of Steph and myself to thank you as well for all the incredible support that our fans and listeners and readers showed us throughout the month of May. It truly was a spectacular month from start to finish. Steph and I were very proud to be able to bring you a lot of the coverage that we were, particularly the Centennial Interview Series. We really hope that you enjoyed hearing all those interviews with the living legends of the 500 as much as we enjoyed getting the opportunity to conduct those interviews. I think we had a great month. We look forward already to next year's month of May. But, of course, before then, we still have to close out the 2011 IZOD IndyCar Series season, which by all accounts looks to be a fantastic season throughout the rest of the year. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up the show. Remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, podcasts, photos, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.